Take a network break. Get your weekly dose of virtual donuts and a hot, fresh cup of IT news and analysis. Today's show is sponsored in part by VMware's VMworld. It's taking place September 29th through October 1st as a live virtual event. Register now for keynotes, a deep dive, technical sessions, and more at VMworld.com. We're also sponsored by TeamViewer. In the age of remote work, how can distributed workforces keep their IT systems running smoothly while ensuring stability and security? TeamViewer remote management lets organizations of all sizes monitor business-critical aspects of their IT, centralize important device information, patch vulnerabilities, and more. You can learn about TeamViewer remote management at teamviewer.com/networkbreak. That's teamviewer.com/networkbreak. Last but not least, stay tuned. After the news, we have a sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with NetMotion. We're going to discuss how to achieve secure remote access without compromising user experience. All right, let's get to the news. Greg, this is a milestone. I know that's not a big deal to you, but this is show 300 of the Network Break.
Yeah, well, 300 means what, six-ish sort of years of doing this?
Wow, could it be 6 years? Yeah.
Could it be 6 years? There you go. So that's how long you've been with Packet Pushers, I guess. So
doesn't seem
how much sanity do you have left? How badly have you been scarred working with...
So you presume I came in with sanity. That was my trick.
Yeah. So here at Packet Pushers, we don't generally celebrate milestones like this. It's kind of... because that's about us. And one of the things we try to do on our podcast and the way that we think about things is it's about the audience. You're our customers. And so for us to sort of get all, you know, big-headed about show 300 and run around, blah, 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 it's not really the way we work, except to say, well, you know, thanks so much for being with us for 6 years-ish, however long it's been. We'll be continuing to produce the show regularly and trying to get it right. And one of the best things we introduced in the last year or so, Drew, I think, is the FU section where people can send us their follow-up and tell us what we're getting right, what we're getting wrong, give us information, give us inside information. And that's actually been, I don't know, probably the biggest success in the last 12 months, I think. What do you think?
I think so. It's been nice to get audience feedback because we do get corrections, we get commentary, and we get insight. So we, and it also shows that folks are out there actually listening and paying attention, which is nice.
Yeah, particularly when people come back and correct us, and then because it can be, you know, we do a lot or cover a lot of stuff in here, and it's easy enough to make a mistake, and we don't want to be wrong, and we're happy to admit when we're wrong too. It's not like we're, you know, didactically, and it's not like we've got a team of journalists here slaving over and editors and fact checkers. It's just us.
We need some interns. That's what we need. Some interns.
Yeah, teams or something. That'd be really nice. Yeah. So, yeah.
In any case, episode 300, and really we do appreciate the time and attention you give us because there are many other ways you could be spending your time. So thank you. We do take it seriously.
For sure.
All right, let's move on to the news. That's why we're here. Cisco has announced the CNWAN project. CNWAN, it's an effort to better integrate Kubernetes-based applications with SD-WAN. The example Cisco is using to describe this new project is a video conferencing app where you might want to prioritize the video and audio microservices on a faster WAN link and the slides and chat feature on a best effort link.
Yeah, so this is, there's goods and bads to this, right? So I sort of sitting on the fence here. My immediate reaction was like the Church of Kubernology is an entirely flexible thing. You know, they're willing to worship all forms of Kubernetes in its many strange and various forms. And in a lot of ways, Kubernetes is like blockchain. And once you become a Kubernetes believer, it's the answer to everything. And now we just have to keep finding the right question for it. It's just this. But there's a certain amount of sense to this. What Cisco's doing, as best as I can tell from the blog post, is they're adding some sort of SD-WAN awareness capability to Kubernetes so that you can place your containers according to the SD-WAN performance. So if you want to be able to say, I need a certain level of performance for a certain service, maybe what I want to be able to do is to deploy a container to the edge of the network that I'm building so that it's closer to where the person is. On the other hand, if I've got a high-speed link and the WAN is performing optimally, then maybe I don't have to deploy a container at the edge of the network. I can just stick it in the core and the experience would be managed. That sounds entirely reasonable, doesn't it?
Yeah, I take your meaning about the church of Kubernology. It seems like everything is now being slathered with either AI, ML, or Kubernetes, sometimes all three. So you can generate a kind of an eye roll, but there is potentially something here. If you've got a use case for it, I think the video conferencing one is potentially a conceivably good use case. And frankly, there's this sort of land rush toward Kubernetes and integrating all of the microservices applications, finding ways to monitor, tweak, all of that. So tying in the hot space of SD-WAN to the hot space of Kubernetes, I guess, from a certainly a marketing perspective, makes sense.
Yeah, but the flip side of this is it's incredibly niche, right? Because in effect, what you're saying is if you're using containers, and you're running Kubernetes for that, not some other form. And to be fair, Kubernetes is the dominant player. But a lot of people are actually doing manual container deployment, not just using Kubernetes APIs for it. So there's a fair amount of slap here. The other thing that's happening here is a lot of CDN companies are allowing you to deploy containers into their platforms, and including in private networks as well. So companies like Cloudflare and Fastly, Verizon, which acquired a provider a couple of years ago, is now you've got the ability to go and deploy containers into their CDNs using their platforms. So this has to do something that those solutions aren't. And these sorts of tools need mass adoption to make them useful and to survive and to thrive. Like, is there something in this module that Cisco's bringing that makes it attractive to developers? And I think the bigger question here is, do developers generally, who are not necessarily even know that Cisco exists, right? Mm-hmm. But do they perceive a company like Cisco as a viable progenitor for Kubernetes things? Because the developer community is often led by fashion, and they generally don't see, they sort of see the Ciscos or the IBMs or the HPE as sort of like the dad bods of the fashion world. You know, like, that's nice, but it's, you know, there's only so many polo shirts and a pair of tan, you know, shorts Flex. That you really want yeah. to see. Do you yes. know what I mean? Yeah. Yes. So generally the Kubernetes people are much more affected by the house of Google or the Azure, you know, cloud sort of thing, you know, much more than the Target, like Cisco and HPE and IBM, which is, so I think, you know, Cisco's got a problem here. Can they actually get traction with this in a developer community that would generally regard, not see Cisco as a viable progenitor of such a project? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I understand that critique. I would say, I think, based on my understanding of how Cisco has carved this out, they have done a good job of trying to separate out the NetOps side of it from the DevOps side of it, in that developers only have to do a couple of things, essentially, to my reading, flip on a few metadata tags to say, you know, this microservice is looking for this kind of performance level, and then Cisco lets the network folks take care of the rest. So there is a Kubernetes component, but they're trying to separate out the developer engagement as much as possible, knowing that developers don't give two figs about Cisco. So I think the approach they're taking is the right one.
Yeah, I think so. I think the challenge here too is it doesn't, it talks about being bound pretty tightly to the Viptela SD-WAN.
Of course. Yes.
So that's getting into a fairly niche audience, because only if you've got an SD-WAN can you use this module. Or the flip side, or the reverse of that statement must be true, which is, I want to use this placement feature, therefore I will go and buy a Viptela SD-WAN. Mm-hmm. Now, those are two quite complicated. You know, there's not that many SD-WANs deployed in the world today. We're still measuring them in the thousands. And not everybody wants to buy a Viptela SD-WAN, and not everybody who's buying a Viptela SD-WAN wants a Kubernetes capability to deploy things on the other side of it. So I just wonder if it's like a bit niche, if that makes sense.
Yeah, based on the initial documentation that I'm looking at, it does feel like a very niche play for some very specific use cases. So yes, niche. I don't see it as being some kind of huge innovation that's going to take over the world. I do see Cisco positioning this as a way to differentiate Viptela. And I also see it as Cisco being able to tell a Kubernetes story, which makes them look good.
Yeah. Well, I think the challenge here is going to be, can Cisco get profile so that people know that this exists? And can they sustain this? Cisco has, to my mind, a reputation for kicking off open source projects like this. And then 6 months later, they're like on life support. And 6 months later, the website's still there, but that's just about it. So I would question it. I would be asking the salesperson involved if you wanted to talk to your sales rep. This does have the bit of a stink that there's a customer out there who wanted it and Cisco developed it. Like there's one big account. And I'd be wanting to get inside of that to say, who's that account and why are you developing it? What's your motivations? Because this has the sort of, if that customer sort of wanted it and was willing to go for it, and then all of a sudden in 2 years' time they walk away from it, the product might die and your business is dependent on it. I'd be inclined to look at, you know, there's challenges there about the long-term strategic viability of this that I'd need answers to. So you might want to ask those questions if you go into procurement.
Absolutely. We've got a link to the blog if you want to read that, and also a link to the GitHub page where Cisco has a lot of documentation on this if you want to get more. CenturyLink and Level 3, their Level 3 business, suffered a five-hour incident on August 30th that affected its own customers and other ISPs. The root cause was a bad flow spec announcement that disrupted BGP sessions.
Yeah, so this was big news. CenturyLink, of course, has got a pretty bad reputation amongst the internet community generally. Level 3 had a bad reputation before CenturyLink acquired them, and it hasn't gotten any better after this incident this week. If you are actually an enterprise customer connected to CenturyLink or Level 3, you might want to reevaluate your business decisions in the light of what happened. Five-hour incident in the US. It took me a little while to realize that all of the coverage talked about the outage in the US, and none of them actually talked about it being global because all of the coverage was by US websites. But some of the people in the Packet Pusher Slack channel were commenting that they were experiencing outages in the UK and through and across Europe. So it wasn't just the US, it was much wider than the US. There was a lot of, as the incident unfolded and people were chatting, it turns out that even though you were de-peering with CenturyLink, so if you were shutting down your peers with CenturyLink because they were black-holing the routes, they weren't rescinding the routes. They weren't taking the routes down and still advertising them out of their network. And so they were acting as a black hole for many of their customers.
Right.
Now, in theory, shouldn't happen, but CenturyLink's BGP was less than perfectly configured. They're claiming in their outage that FlowSpec, they pushed a FlowSpec rule which had wildcards. Normally it's used to push a single IP address, and somebody put a wildcard. And the general assumption is that the FlowSpec rule might have actually blocked their route reflector or their BGP peering or access to the systems in some way until they actually worked out what was wrong. But it took them 5 hours to get there. I must say, reading the outage report, it sounds like there was an awful lot of CenturyLink executives standing in the operations center yelling and screaming at people, and it was generally not well handled. Reading between the lines,
it really
was.
That's probably the worst thing you could do, frankly. Yes.
Yeah.
To have executives screaming doesn't help.
No, it really sounds like, you know, reading between the lines of the outage report, whoever wrote it was obviously closely involved, and it was like, anyway, the final outcome, ThousandEyes did a great job of getting deeper into this, but they're asking the same question as us. In theory, there's no way that FlowSpec should cause this to happen. And internally for them to be able to do this is pretty bad form. In the outage, their rectification action is to decommission their whole FlowSpec system in its entirety, and it will remain offline. Now, that has an impact because FlowSpec is used to manage DDoS.
Right.
And you can shut down an IP address so that it can't DDoS. And so now the CenturyLink network is vulnerable to DDoS attacks and may suffer resource exhaustion until this comes back online. So they're now putting secondary filters in place to modify wildcard entries. Somebody also suggested that potentially they had a customer who they were letting send FlowSpec to them as part of their customer's DDoS prevention, so that the idea would be that the customer could send a DDoS flow spec rule and CenturyLink would implement it. And maybe one of their customers sent a wildcarded flow spec by accident and then took down the entire network.
Yikes.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, they're definitely covering for that customer, which I could see why they would want to do that. But
Yeah. Well, it's their own fault still, right?
Even still, if the customers. Right. Yeah.
You've got to defend just because one of your customers took your network out doesn't prevent you from absolve your blame. It's your network, it's your business, it's your problem.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Check those flow spec configs.
So generally it looks, CenturyLink didn't come out of this at all positively. It took them a very long time to diagnose it, I think, is the general view of people that I saw. and their reaction was slow, disjointed. They weren't communicating effectively, so on and so forth. So,
Yeah, I mean, the one bright spot for them, I guess, is that it happened on a Sunday here in the United States, which means it was potentially less disruptive than it could have been if it had happened right during Smack workday. So,
yeah, well, it did affect Europe in the workday.
Right, that's true.
Yeah, so who cares about the UAS?
Well, people who live here do. About 300 million people do, yeah, but that's okay.
And about 380 million here in Europe.
Touche.
Yeah. On that note,
let's tell you about VMware's VMworld. The live virtual event takes place September 29th through October 1st. You get a free registration that gives you access to the whole enchilada. So keynotes, product presentations, technical deep dives, everything. I'm going to be checking out what VMware is up to with data center networking and the cloud, including the latest on its Tanzu platform. I'm also hoping to get a closer look at its service mesh offerings. Greg, anything that's caught your eye?
There's one I was looking at, which was deploying NSXT over a Cisco ACI site and multi-site infrastructure. And it is true that for many customers, they do have Cisco ACI in the underlay. And Cisco ACI multi-site has been a popular, some customers have actually purchased that. And so this is trying to lay out the framework for how you deploy NSXT and over an ACI deployment. Now, most people I know just say we deploy it and don't care what the ACI does. But I'll be interested to see what the interoperation is. And there's another one I'm looking at, which is the active software-defined data center with NSX advanced load balancing solutions. I think that's a really interesting one because active data centers are super difficult. Mm. They remain difficult, have been for many years. So I'll be dropping in on those two sessions. They are the ones that I'll be looking at.
Fantastic. Well, you can go find out what you want to see at vmworld.com. Registration is free and it's open now. Back to the news. Multiple vulnerabilities have been uncovered in Cisco's iOS XR software that could slow or crash the IGMP process on the device and cause memory exhaustion that could affect other processes on the device.
Yeah, this is sort of an advertisement for modern network operating systems, really. That was the thing that instantly, apparently it's related to the DVMRP protocol, which is a way legacy multicast. And when I dropped some commentary to somebody in the Slack channel, this week they said, what's DVMRP? And I was like, oh boy, do I feel old now. I don't think there's too many people in the public who actually need DVMRP, but the code is actually running. And there is actually exploits in the wild, which are actually seeing the routers get taken out in iOS XR. And my initial reaction here is this is why you're seeing modular network operating systems becoming very popular. So if you're running a public cloud infrastructure, if you're running a modern networking hosting environment, you don't want routers that are running legacy protocols like DVMRP that can be taken out like this. Mm-hmm. If there's protocols in your code base that you're not using, so if you're just using BGP, why do you have the OSPF module running at all? Why not just turn it off? And this is a sort of a roaming advertisement for that. We know that Cisco consistently has bugs and vulnerabilities in their code. This is just one of a half a dozen such vulnerabilities this week. We picked this one up just because I wanted to talk about it highlights why modular NOS is. But Cisco's had a half a dozen of these this week of security vulnerabilities of different forms across its portfolio. And as we say most weeks, Cisco continues to struggle with producing quality code that is safe and predictable, I think.
And we should say, I believe that iOS XR is a modular-based operating system. Wasn't that one of the reasons they built it?
Well, apparently not. Like, you know, some of them are and some of them aren't. So maybe it's the older versions of the code base, but if you look up the security advisory and check out if it's relevant to you. But yeah, I think they're making attempts to make it modular, but still part of what they did was they ran a Linux kernel and then they still put the monolith on top. And only some things are in containers, not everything. So it's not even as simple as it's modular. The answer is it's not just that easy at all. So
of course, yeah. We do have a link to the alert in the show notes. Cisco says workarounds are available. Software patches are coming, but not yet available. So you may want to check the workarounds.
The workaround is just to deny IGMP any DVMRP. So
yeah, there you go.
Not hard, right, but not good.
Yes. Moving on, Broadcom has announced new Gen 7 fiber channel switches for storage networking. The Gen 7 switches run at 64 gigabits per second, doubling the previous version and reduce latency by half.
Ah, the never-ending comedy of fiber channel that will be with us forever. So basically, this is, congratulations, 64 gigabits per second fiber channel. Is that it? We're done?
That's it. That's it, pretty much.
apparently the Broadcom has basically shipped some 64 gigabit fiber channel switching gear. It's actually been announced a while ago. We didn't really talk about it because it's not that interesting. The strange thing about this is that if you actually track the research companies, they continue to report that fiber channel revenue is as good as it ever was. It's not particularly shrinking. It's not growing, but it's not shrinking either.
Right, right.
And the other thing I sort of noticed was this Gen 6, Gen 7 marketing thing. Have you sort of – it was interesting that Brocade came out with this before it was bought by Broadcom. And it was basically a tool to try and say to customers, there's a better fiber channel. So instead of just calling it 32 gig fiber channel and 64 gig fiber channel, they started calling this Gen 6, Gen 7. And it's a bit like the Wi-Fi 6 thing. Right.
Yes.
And it's actually this, it's very interesting because I've come to the conclusion that vendors know that obsoleting equipment sells more stuff, right? If you go out and say, oh, you've got Wi-Fi 5, we've got Wi-Fi 6 out now, you should be planning for an upgrade, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that sells products, not because customers need them or want them or, you know, and in some cases, you know, whatever, but just because people want to have the latest. And I wonder how much of this sort of marketing is going to keep going on. Like, we've seen Cisco do the same thing when they relabeled all of their products, you know, the 9000 series and the 4000 series. And the logical reason for that is that now they can start getting into this, you know, if everything's a ASR 9000 or an ISR 9000 or whatever it is, then when you go to the 10,000, the implicit message is your 9000 is now obsolete.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so it's a lazy way of selling. And so customers should need to be very, very smart to make sure that vendors aren't EOLing stuff before it's actually reached its useful life, because that's one way to leverage customers to drive upgrade cycles and to extract revenue for very little work.
I take your meaning that this is, you know, Gen 7 makes it sound like, oh my goodness, a whole new wonderful marketing hoopla. But
yeah,
also the fact is it is twice as fast, so that's good.
But that's it.
That's what you want. Yeah, well, that's it. Yes.
it's not better. It doesn't enhance the signaling. It supports NVMe over fabrics, but so did the existing Gen 6 stuff. It's not, there's nothing there except...
It's the marketing department that's bored and need to spice things up for themselves.
Yeah, but it is, you know, if you're a marketing department and you're trying to generate some buzz and help drive sales, it's a handy tool.
But as a
customer, which is who's theoretically listening to this podcast, you should be incredibly cynical about these, you know, Wi-Fi 6, Wi-Fi, you know, Wi-Fi 6.5, Gen 6, Gen 7 fiber channel, you know, all of this sort of stuff, because it is a pretty cynical marketing tool to try and it recognizes that a lot of customers lack expertise and lack vision and strategy. And if somebody comes along and says, oh, it's it's the 2020 Ford Ranchero. It must be better than the 2018 Ford Ranchero. I don't know. Is that a car? Is that a thing?
I don't know, but it sounds like it could be. It sure does.
But, you know, and there are people who will literally, you know, head out and say, well, I'll have to have the latest one. So be careful with that. I think you need to be a smart buyer.
Absolutely. All right. An IT director is going to spend 2 years in jail for selling Cisco switches owned by the local government he worked for. According to reports, over the course of 3 years, this person ordered 41 Cisco switches that were supposed to be installed on the government county's network, but instead he sold them on eBay.
Yeah. So no, as far as a crime goes, pretty run of the mill, really. Buy some products, get it into the warehouse, then put it in your car, drive it home, sell it out into the resale market, and probably nobody would have noticed.
Tell your crew, don't worry, I'll handle the installation on this one, and then you take it home and sell it.
Something like that. And I thought, that's pretty interesting in its way, right? So it's kind of like a thing. But what it struck me is I was thinking about how Cisco's new software dependent licensing model and how you have to license all the kit. And if there's one thing I see a lot of people talking about, it's just how hard it is to work with Cisco's licensing strategy fairly endlessly. And if you consider that every piece of kit that you now put into a network has a license associated with it and has to be registered with Cisco and to some extent contactable by Cisco. So you either have a software licensing gateway or you have some sort of manual process. Because if you don't, if the license isn't validated, the equipment downgrades to what is practically an unusable state.
Right.
So we're now in a situation where the current generation of products that Cisco sells, Cisco knows where they all are. To, like, at the very least, they know that this serial number is associated with this account and it has these licenses associated with it. So there's a really interesting piece of corporate surveillance going on there in that Cisco now knows where every one of these products is and nominally in which network they're deployed. So they now know who's buying secondhand Cisco kit and who's deploying Cisco secondhand kit as well.
Yeah, and I wonder whether it was, you know, other employees in the organization who cottoned onto this, or maybe it was Cisco who tipped somebody off to say, there's something going on here that's not right.
I think so. It's just interesting to think about this. So, you know, if you think something's been stolen from your organization, you will be able to go to Cisco and you may need law enforcement to assist you. But Cisco now has a database of its products, of the newer products, of course, the ones that use this feature, and you'll be able to find them if they get stolen or if they walk off the premises. So it's something to think about. Corporate surveillance has many forms.
Yeah, we talk about this as corporate surveillance, but in this case, I guess it worked out well for the county government who can take action against this employee.
Who knows? I don't know whether they use this feature, but it just struck me. It was a topic worth discussing and highlighting to get you thinking about these issues anyway.
All right, quick break to tell you about our sponsor, TeamViewer. Don't let IT vulnerabilities go unknown. With TeamViewer remote management, your IT department can stay one step ahead of infrastructure issues, including centralized device monitoring, asset management, proactive patch management, network monitoring, endpoint protection with Windows and Mac OS support, and GDPR-compliant data backup and storage. Plus, you get visibility into important aspects of your IT, including disk space, disk health, CPU and memory usage, system updates, firewalls, event logs, and much more. TeamViewer is offering our listeners a chance to try remote management free for 14 days. Head on over to teamviewer.com/networkbreak to get started with IT free of interruptions. That's teamviewer.com/networkbreak, and we thank them for being a sponsor. All right, our last story before we wrap, space networking. Last week, SpaceX launched more satellites into orbit for its proposed Starlink satellite broadband service. SpaceX is saying its internal trials show download speeds in excess of 100 megabits per second. But as we talked about in a previous episode, some leaked data from private beta show that that's not quite the case.
That's right. When we had an article last week from Pots and Pans, sort of highlighting the fact that there was a bunch of speed test sites showing tests that were using Starlink, and the performance was sort of in the 10 to 50 megabits per second range.
Right.
And so the first thing to sort of, and that was like disappointing because in the first stage, Elon Musk had promised gigabit speeds. And so, you know, the usual Silicon Valley promise the world, deliver very little seems to be in action here. And particularly Elon Musk, who promises a lot and then, when it comes to actually delivering, he tends to deliver far less than the initial commitment. But it's made him very, you know, he continues to go from success to success. So it's disappointing to see that somebody can just, you know, basically lie and then correct the lies later on and then get away with it to their own financial benefit. There's no penalty to him just making stuff up, apparently. So right now they're saying their internal tries show download speeds in excess of 100 megabits per second. But what we're actually seeing in field trials where people are doing speed tests from their houses who are in the beta program, 10 to 50 megs is more common. Okay, so the network is still in beta, and much of the information that I've read is sort of pointing the finger at the ground terminal. So these are the satellite dishes that point up, and they are line-powered satellite dishes that rest on your roof. So they're not actually wired in. It's not like you have to go and hire an installer who then comes out and installs something on your roof and drills holes. It is literally a dish that you can just stand on a desk. And I can imagine that there are people doing dumb things like standing it on a desk inside their house and then connecting it to the satellite and then saying, oh, it's not going very fast. So I'm willing to be tolerant and wait to see what the final part of it is. But And another thing I note is that the article that we quoted in last week's show has been deleted. It's not there.
Right.
So that might tell you something, probably that somebody has been bullied, you know, as somebody who's a blogger who does get bullied fairly regularly by vendors, that's usually indication of something. So
yeah, you're referencing a blog by a person who blogs at Pots and Pans, who does a lot of reporting on the telco space. There's a link to an article about Starlink speed test that's not there anymore. I found another story that quotes the blog that's still up, but the blog itself is gone. And yeah, we don't know why.
Yeah, a bit disappointing in that sense. So we do feel like there's something going on here. Starlink, either is upset or somebody at Starlink is upset. So who knows? So I'm sort of at the point where this is the fat man on the bus scenario. The fat man runs around going, don't sit there. I'm going to sit there because, you know, I want to sit there. And so nobody can sit there because there's no space on the seat. And then if the fat man doesn't sit there, the seat's empty. And that's a way of creating a market for yourself is by big mouthing that you're going to do something. Normally we see companies like Microsoft or IBM or Cisco sort of, you know, oh, we're going to enter into this market. And then when they say they do, everybody in the market gets conniptive fits because that market's now suddenly closed off to normal players.
Right.
So a bit disappointing to see Starlink sort of take some fairly dodgy practices. It was up until now, they've shown every signs of being like a, you know, focused on the customer and going forward with openness and integrity. And now suddenly we're at this phase and they're going down a different path. So let's treat everything that comes out of Starlink going forward with a big dose of dubiousness.
Absolutely. Anything to do with Elon Musk, you have to take with a shaker of salt, not just a grain, because he has a track record for hyping things up. Eventually, he may get to where he wants to go, but at the outset, there's lots of grandiose promises. The other issue SpaceX has is they're gunning to get their hands on a $16 billion pot of funding from the FCC to provide rural broadband. So they need to have this in shape to meet the FCC's requirements, which include, I think, average download speeds of around 25 megabits per second and 100 milliseconds of latency. So there is money on the table for them for this. One other thing I want to mention, we've been talking a lot about rural broadband. It's insane to me that to actually try to get rural broadband into the hands of users, we have to go into space to do this. It's overly complicated. Yeah. There are lots of other ways we could build out broadband to people in the United States.
Yeah, the instinct I have from reading about it is this won't be a replacement for broadband. You still need cable in the ground. This is still a hack, and it will never be as viable as cable in the ground will be. And if I was based in the US and had hopes that this was going to be a replacement for a DSL service or some, you know, telcos trenching fiber into the ground, I don't think that's actually true. That remains to be seen, because the first generation of satellites talked about having laser interconnects. They were using free space optics in space to point to each other. But the current generation of satellites, actually you go up and then you come back down. So there's no routing it sideways or horizontally in the network. There's just up, down. And so that might explain some of the variability, because if your satellite isn't quite in the right place, you might not be getting in it. And so you go up, down, up, down, up, down. That's how it passes traffic. It's more like a peer-to-peer system.
Good
That's
Lord.
Why the performance might be so variable. But rather than speculate like that, I just think we should just wait and see what the final product is when it ships, you know, and admit that, you know, these are early days for SpaceLink. They're still launching satellites. They did a mission again on Sunday to launch another batch of satellites up there. Maybe they're replacing this because the satellites are very small. They're able to launch 60 to 100 in a single launch. This suggests that they could iterate. And one of the things that SpaceX has done is iterate. They don't build a satellite and then just use that for the next 10 years. They tend to do a thing and then iterate very rapidly. It's like a factory. And if that's the case, then potentially they might have said, well, we'll just get the first satellites up and use that as a pilot project and learn some lessons and then iterate. And then we'll just keep launching more satellites. And they'll all be different and they may all be, you know, blah, 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 and rapidly redesign and rapidly relearn and optimize. So let's wait and see. But my gut feel is that this won't be a replacement for rural broadband. It's even as much as they might wish it would be, I still think the governments should be looking to deploy fiber to the curb or fiber in the ground and investing heavily to do so.
Absolutely, or bringing fiber to some kind of point and then bridging the last mile or last few miles with wireless point-to-multipoint, point-to-point, that kind of thing. There are other options available that don't require you boosting satellites into space to do this.
Yes.
That's anyway, right. We'll see. You know, maybe a year from now, we'll be telling a different story. Who knows?
He's hoping. It would be, in theory, it would be much more effective to have a space network covering the rural sites than to roll out the cable. But we'll just have to wait and see.
All right, that wraps up our news. Stay tuned for our conversation on secure remote access and user experience with our sponsor, NetMotion. That's coming right up. Welcome to Tech Bytes, a 15-minute podcast at the intersection of technology and business. Today's sponsor is secure remote access company NetMotion, and we're going to talk about how to achieve secure remote access without compromising user experience. Our guest is Chris Edgman. He is systems engineer at NetMotion. Hey, Chris, welcome to the podcast. To get us started, can you give us a very brief explanation of NetMotion and what the company does?
Yeah, sure. NetMotion, we're a software company, and we offer a security platform that does three things. First, we offer a SDP solution. Second, we have a VPN client. And third, we are a digital experience monitoring solution.
So, Chris, our topic for today is security without compromising user experience. And unfortunately, as an end user, I know personally, sometimes security is a hassle. There are layers of access control, complex passwords. I might be restricted from a resource I need. So how is NetMotion threading that needle of security while still providing a good user experience?
So here at NetMotion, we have our digital experience monitoring solution, which is really about providing a productive but yet secure connected environment for the remote workers.
You said a couple of things in there. You said digital experience monitoring and connectivity. So that suggests that now you're sort of leading with the monitoring side, but I wonder if the connectivity solution is just as important. Do you want to expand on that?
Oh, yeah, sure. So the I would say the success of any remote access solution is basically judged by its ability to deliver the service and resources required by the business to the end users in the field. And that's what we specialize in, while keeping them secure and then under the control of the business and the organization.
So what you're saying there is your remote access solution, you give the ability to connect users at the edge of the network to the resources wherever they might be. Talked about that before in other shows. But what you're also emphasizing, I think, here is the fact that you're also monitoring the performance of those services. So if you've got a user in the network somewhere and they say, oh, performance is really, really bad, you've got this monitoring, you call it digital experience monitoring, which allows me to say, oh, yes, that user has a problem. Is that the sort of idea?
Exactly. So if you compare it to typical IT infrastructure, there's typically a disconnect between your network engineers, let's say, and the end users using the applications, especially when it comes to remote access. And the reason for that is because the landscape and the game has changed, right? It's a different environment. The KPIs are a little different. And, the stability, performance, continuity offered by, infrastructure-based networks are not the same and not available for remote users.
So you're A, going to connect users to the core of the network. B, you're going to monitor the application part. Where does the security part come in?
So the security part comes through our SDP solution. So we have the ability through our platform to implement zero trust network access. And we have full control over those devices in the field, over all the applications, what they're accessing, over which networks, and the ability to lock that access down so that we have full control and visibility into whatever users are doing on the network and what they're accessing. And we can help protect them, for any security risks out there as well.
So SDP, that's a software-defined perimeter?
That's right, software-defined perimeter.
And when you say full control of an end-user device, that means if, they're at home and they want to scurry off to a site that's not necessarily work approved while they're at home, you can block that during business hours?
Absolutely. So we have a policy engine that is unlike a typical firewall ACL in that it offers a contextual-based approach to implementing the different rule sets, right? So we can detect where a user's connecting from, the time of day, the type of network, and then implement rules based on for that particular user on, based on those parameters. And so if we see a user accessing a site that would be risky, we can use our reputation service to block access to that site and keep that user and his device protected.
And does this require backhauling all the traffic to my headquarters, or can I do that right on the device?
No, you can do that right on the device. We don't require any tunneling of traffic back into the data center, into the customer's data center. So, but you still have full visibility, even though the traffic's not going on premise, you still have full visibility into that traffic and the ability to see and control that.
So how do you do that, right? Because if you've got devices at the edge of the network, you're not sending them off to the cloud to funnel it through some sort of inspection engine. Do you rely on an agent then in the endpoints?
Exactly. Every client has our agent installed on the endpoint, which we provide authentication, and we're going to secure and encrypt any traffic from between that client and the server. But that client gives us full control over all the networking on that particular device.
Something else I know about NetMotion, and I don't see it often with other remote access products, is this notion of application session persistence. Can you drill into that a little bit more? What is application session persistence and how are you getting it?
So application session persistence is one of the features in our platform, and it's the ability to maintain application connections even when the network isn't there, or if the users are relying on multiple networks for access. For redundancy options, we can support that application when it loses connectivity, when it switches networks, for instance, between Wi-Fi to cellular. And it also helps boost efficiency through things like our datagram coalescence and compression, MTU detection, other things like that. We're able to maximize that end user experience and keep those applications and sessions alive, regardless of any challenges that might affect them with connectivity.
Now, that is a very, very cool feature, because I could imagine if I'm a user at work and I work at home, because we're working from home now, and I'm connected to an application in the core of your network, and it's some sort of legacy application that usually keep alive or tries to sustain itself, and if you stop being connected, it drops the user session. You've got tools that can actually sustain that and keep that going, even if, you know, as you say, if my home Wi-Fi went down and I had to run down the road to a local coffee shop or something, then it would still work. The application persistence would come up again.
That's correct. It's exactly how it works. So we're going to keep those user sessions open and active despite losing the network, which will help minimize the number of logins per user per day. Help with our support staff and dealing with, you know, authentication related help desk tickets and other type connectivity issues. So, we've run surveys in the past and found that mobile workers, report that password issues and having to re-authenticate is probably the fifth most frustrating issue they deal with in the field.
Right. So you're saying if I'm working at home, my cable modem goes out and I switch over to, my cellular provider, I may not have to re-log into an application that I was just working on.
Exactly. So the client will sense that we have another network available, in this case, your cellular network. And when we lose that Wi-Fi connection, it will just roam seamlessly over and move that application connection over to the cellular without any sort of interruption.
I'm thinking of a certain corporate expenses application, which is notoriously painful to deal with. That I might have had to deal with in a corporate previous life. And I think I might have actually resigned from that company just because of the expenses app, which was pretty horrible.
Yes, it can be very frustrating. In that same survey, respondents identified several issues that affect connectivity and add to that frustration, captive portals, slow networks, devices that show false connectivity, all those things decrease that end user's experience and take away from their productivity. And also we see a rise in help desk tickets as a result of that.
And also like the fact that your agent, because you've got policies on the agent, it actually makes the device secure. So even though you might be running the device on the home network, it's actually secured from the home network because the agent controls traffic going out, but also controls traffic coming in, right?
Exactly. Bidirectional traffic. We have full control of traffic leaving and entering the device and we can detect security issues with the person's home network. For instance, if they had an open Wi-Fi network that is insecure, we can have the client detect that. And as a result, tunnel all traffic and make sure it's encrypted and secured and keeping that traffic safe.
Mm. So with folks working from home, that kind of complicates already complicated security challenges. What kind of security capabilities do I have with NetMotion to make sure that home user is secure?
So we have our policy engine, of course, which is going to let us manage all the traffic. So we can pick what applications we need to tunnel, what applications we need to send outside the tunnel, anything we need to block. This ties in with our reputation service, where we can check the risk level and category of a particular endpoint that they're accessing. And so if they're accessing a proxy anonymizer or some site like that, we can go and block that traffic. Mm-hmm. So we can keep them from going to places that they shouldn't. You know, the big thing with remote access is it's dynamic. It can change between different points in time. We're also relying on a lot of networks that we don't control, but we still want to keep them secure. And also, you know, network connectivity is not always going to be there, unlike a traditional wired network infrastructure. And so, just like we mentioned earlier, we allow them to move that connection across different networks seamlessly. And that way, we improve their uptime, keep those applications connected, keep that traffic secure, and then we're able to adapt that based on changing conditions in the network.
Something you mentioned I want to drill down into, if I've got, you know, legacy or heritage, as Greg calls them, applications in the data center, but I'm also using SaaS apps, I can tunnel back to the data center, but I can also use TLS to go to the SaaS app and still get a secure connection without having that extra hop through the data center?
So yeah, you can pick and choose what traffic needs to be sent to your data center, which needs to be sent directly out to the internet. And then those rules can also change based on that user's connectivity.
Okay, great. So I get that flexibility if for some reason something changes.
That's right. So the client detects those network changes. We have granular control over all that client traffic. You know, we can pick and choose what we want to tunnel or split tunnel, any combination of the application, the IP address, the ports, the host name, the domain, the reputation of the site. And so we can use any one of those in combination to key on the traffic and figure out what needs to be split tunnel, what needs to be sent back through the tunnel into our data center.
Chris, one more question before we wrap up. What about multi-factor authentication? Can you guys support that, work with that?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, multi-factor poses some challenges to the remote workers in the field, especially when your device is losing connectivity and the user's forced to, you know, pull out a token or use a phone app or any of those type factors. We can minimize that to a once-a-day activity for that user, despite losing the network, despite switching networks, or, you know, if they were to put the device to sleep or in hibernate mode, we can still maintain that session, maintain those application sessions, so that they can stay productive without having to go through that whole login process over and over.
So that's nice, taking away that one extra irritation of having to re-authenticate for whatever reason. I could see that being refreshing.
I assume that that's configurable. If you wanted them to log in every 2 hours or 4 hours, you could do that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can force re-authentication. You know, if someone were to leave a laptop wide open at a coffee shop or something, and another user were to come in and take control of that device, you know, we can have set re-authentication intervals so that we can make sure it's our user on the other end and not a bad actor.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Chris, thanks for joining us. And for listeners, if you want to find out more about the NetMotion platform and how to improve your remote access experience, you can go to netmo.io/techbyte. That's netmo.io/techbyte. We'll also have that link in the show notes. But thanks, Chris, for being a guest. And thanks to NetMotion for sponsoring the Packet Pushers. Sponsors let us produce high-quality technical content that we can then share with listeners for free. Speaking of which, you can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter. That's at Packet Pushers. Find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much remote networking would never be enough.